This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Program Historic Souvenirs. Today we read from a collection of Waikato Times columns written by Gordon Chesterman and published in his book Water Under the Bridge. Pleading for Airpoint members to relinquish Airpoints as a show of solidarity. Dick Hubbard, cereal maker, God bless him, took full pages in several newspapers at a cost of around 29,000 New Zealand dollars. In comparison, our advertisements in six newspapers at a cost of not much more than $2,500, it's because we want our pound of flesh. What we've got is a clear contractual obligation between 300,000 travelling New Zealanders and Air New Zealand. As Airpoints members, we've been loyal customers. We've been persuaded to swap our credit cards from Visa to MasterCard to build up more Airpoints. We stay at certain hotel chains, drive rental cars belonging to one firm, join the AA, link up with telecoms calling points, and all to add more Airpoints for ourselves. Even young couples prefer home loans from Bank of New Zealand because they get a bundle of Airpoints, enough to go to Aussie. But a business deal it is. Air New Zealand went into the business of aggressively marketing its loyalty program. They and their marketing partners owe us, every one of us. What Save Our Airpoints wants is a rock-solid guarantee that once the financial position of Air New Zealand is secured, Airpoint members will be told their points are safe. That's not being greedy, disloyal to the nation, or mean-spirited. We want to see Air New Zealand succeed, as do those offering their support to Save Our Airpoints. The truth is, we would have preferred not to have started Save Our Airpoints. Look at it this way. As individuals, we're all potentially unsecured creditors in the worst-case scenario of the airline failing. As individuals, we have no power to argue our position, but as a collective, we have the strength to deliver a hard-hitting message to the government, the airline, its shareholders, and marketing partners. We emailed Helen Clark and Air New Zealand's Gary Toomey and told them so. So if the government comes to the rescue by stumping up taxpayer money to save our airline and our airpoints, then Save Our Airpoints becomes redundant. There is a wider issue. Frequent flyer rewards programs have been with us for 20 years or more as an advertising ploy to win market share. With what has happened in the international airline business lately, airlines must rue the day they ever launched these programs. They have become a huge liability, as Air New Zealand has discovered. The real solution is for the airlines to collude. Oh dear, a dreadfully incorrect word. But collude they must. Airlines should close the books on frequent traveller programs and force airpointers to use their points bank within a specified period. That would provide a very level playing field for airlines around the world. They could then focus on cheaper flights. Maybe even the woolly woofters wearing their sandals, who should now demonstrate their staunchness by sending their hard-earned money to help the airline in its hour of need. And they could afford to go flying. This was Gordon Chesterman's contribution, published in the Waikato Times on October the 4th, the year 2001. Later, he writes a follow-up entitled, Two More Sleeps. Not about the start of the American retaliation or the government's $840 million rescue package for Air New Zealand, or about the fate of the air points banked by more than 300,000 loyal Pride of the Pacific flyers. Not about even the fact that Qantas is aggressively snapping up market share from under the nose of our airline. No, not about the refugees who bring their bitterness and prejudices into our country, instead of thanking their lucky stars that they are here. The police finding some offensive weapons in the camp north of Auckland is a worry, however. Not about the sacking of Jenny Shipley as the Nat's big cheese. It's more simple than that. Just two more sleeps. We'll have some new city fathers and mothers. Standing for elected office is like a job interview, except that there's not one employer, but thousands of them giving you the big tick or flick. For some candidates, it's a chance for a career that pays quite well, thank you. Because local body politics has become a career move for some who can earn close to six figures out of various public purses. Even at around $40,000, it's good solid money, particularly if you didn't have a real job before. Undoubtedly, you've taken the time to read the candidate's directory that comes with the voting papers. A bit like the Best Bets horse racing tipster sheet, according to the directory, candidates are all people who will listen, a new phenomenon, and thinkers. Sadly, that's often their only qualification. Who are all committed to keeping rates to inflation or less, although this in itself could be a concern. Not one of them wants to sell off public assets, even though they were never for sale, and they all want to prohibit pokies in the suburbs. Without exception, they'll cut the waste and inefficiencies out of local government, which is entirely appropriate. They'll do all of those things that any lobby group wants to impose on the rest of us, even saving the whales. We can only hope they won't be too brutal on the meeting allowances, the councillors' liquor cupboard, cell phones and taxi chitties and out-of-town conferences. Oh, yes. It's a given that they'll treat each other with respect, with kindness and friendship, and cross their hearts and point to heaven, will not indulge in petty politics. With this kind of commitment as ratepayers, we're in for three excellent years of progress in the region, don't you think? But there is the not-so-good news, too. You might like to reflect on this for a second or two. Of more than 200,000 eligible voters coast to coast in the Waikato Times circulation area, in nine local authorities, excluding the regional council, 94,000 of them don't actually give a toss. They are the wonderfully community-minded people who get a chance to vote, but who can't be bothered to tick a few boxes and post off their voting papers in the supplied postage-paid envelope. How difficult is that, community thinkers? While I have no evidence to support this, it is likely these people are the ones who moan their butts off when mayors and councillors don't meet their demanding standards. That 94,000 potential voters is probably optimistic. My simple arithmetic is based on the returns of the last election, where Waitomo hit 64.5%, followed by Thames Coromandel at 64%, and Hauraki slightly behind with 63.5%. Alas, Hamilton recorded only 53.4% as having voted in 1998, but it's trending down. With just two sleeps, we should get excited about the won't voters. They could exceed 100,000. It's worrying. There's no question the impact of terrorism in America has played a major role by replacing election news at a time when newspaper readers, at least, could reasonably expect to find out more about the candidates and what was happening on the hustings. The election book that I mentioned earlier gave candidates an opportunity to strut their stuff in print and photos and convince us to vote for them. Clearly an excellent idea, and a leaf taken out of the book of the Well Energy Trust, who introduced the concept three elections back. Especially welcome was the decision by most returning officers to specify current photography for this booklet, although this seems to have attracted some debate over just how old some of those photos really were. My suspicion is that right throughout the region, this has been an election where there have been no burning issues. Enough to bring an uprising. It's been boring, frankly. Comparatively, few people have bothered to turn up to the candidates' meetings arranged in the communities. The choice for voters has been too large, particularly when the new area health boards are added into the political pot. The extension of the voting period from 2 weeks to three has contributed little. The one single highlight has been the hugely entertaining Letters to the Editor columns, where the writers number many, but in reality are few. Could the truth ever emerge? Letter writers have been bitter and twisted, humorous, sad, clever, stupid, vicious, brutal. The odd lawyer has undoubtedly been consulted. But at the end of the day, what's to be done to get ordinary New Zealanders to respond and action their democratic right to vote? If you've got the answer, please let me know. October the 11th, 2001. A week later, the column title is A Brutal Business. Picture this. Years ago in Hamilton, we were eavesdropping on two houses. One's in Lake Crescent, Melville. The other across town in Central Claudelands, a stone's throw from Hamilton Boys High School. It's Saturday night. The double-story colonial white house in Lake Crescent is crammed with supporters excited by the smell of success. It's been a hard campaign, with 13 contenders chasing the city's top job. The returning officer telephones later than was expected with the clear-cut result, and the big White House erupts in victory. Over in Claudelands, however, the atmosphere is quiet. A good candidate rejected for a second time. It's an empty feeling. David Braithwaite walks out to his car with his son and drives across town to Lake Crescent to personally congratulate the new city father. That's what you do. It's expected. It's polite. And it's appropriate. Pleasantries are exchanged, but there's no invitation to stay on and have a drink, so he doesn't. For an achiever, it's a difficult-to-comprehend kind of rejection to come to grips with. At Lake Crescent, the champagne corks are popping and disappearing into the swimming pool. The city has a new mayor, elected with an overwhelming 5,000 vote margin. It's been a big, big win. Third time lucky, in fact. Russ Remington takes the mayoral gold chains and the robe from political foe, the Duchess of Hamilton Politics, Margaret Evans, who earlier had decided to step down after 9 years as the city's mother and 24 years of dedicated community service, has come straight up the middle with just over 12,000 votes. Picture this. 3 years later, last weekend, we're eavesdropping again at the same two houses. The two-story White House in Lake Crescent contains an absolutely gutted and distraught one-term mayor and a handful of his acolytes. Over at Claudelands, at the low-slung American rancher, so shocked by the size of the victory, he's like a stunned mullet. Ham and pickles on the table and champagne, beer and wine. There's an eclectic bunch of well-wishers coming and going. There's been a phone call from Lake Crescent. Dave McPherson, the ex-mayor's right-hand man and proudly Independent's new councillor, Roger Hennebry, is there straight from Lakeside. Grant Thomas pops in, as does Peter Boss and the two retiring after one term City Vision councillors, Steve McLennan and Grant Thorburn. Add in excited TV gardener Bill Ward and fellow new councillor Ewan Wilson, his wife Monique and their twin daughters. Hamilton Airport Director Barry Coombs and wife Di are close behind. John Parker shows up with his wife, Dr. Alison Glover, who's fresh from topping the poll to represent South Waikato on the Area Health Board. MP Tony Steele, himself two sleeps away from being appointed National's junior whip, and wife Raywin come in. It's as busy there as the new Hamilton Transport Centre. They're coming and going all night long. 3 years ago, and polling around 2,600 votes, David Braithwaite had to be shattered. His impressive record of community involvement and business success counted for nothing. This time he's got 18,131 big ticks, exactly 50% of the vote, and a huge margin of 7,780 votes. 3 years ago, David Braithwaite's impressive record of community involvement and business success counted for nothing then. But this time, he's got 18,131 big ticks, exactly 50% of the vote, and a huge margin of 7,780 votes. How's that? His cheerful daughter and campaign manager, Penny Braithwaite, calls him. Both stunned and delighted. The win is incredible, whatever way you look at it. It's reason that with his cheerful daughter and campaign manager, they're both stunned and delighted. The win is incredible, whichever way you look at it. At Lake Crescent, there's the shocked, newly deposed mayor, Russ Remington, searching for the reasons. Back at Argyle Street, the mayor-elect, Braithwaite, is soaking up the feeling of an astonishing victory. How sweet that is. For the past few weeks, he had been relaxed, satisfied knowing voters had a real choice. There were no great expectations other than to give the incumbent mayor a run for his money, and he did. The only clue to the rout was the last-minute poll by Versus Research, published on Friday, pointing to a Braithwaite victory. The only clue as to the rout was the last-minute poll by Versus Research, published on Friday, pointing to a Braithwaite victory. Braithwaite, Waikato Stadium boss, accountant and property developer, former city councillor and son of former city mayor Rod Braithwaite and son of former deputy mayor Kathleen Braithwaite and grandson of Dunedin mayor Joseph Braithwaite. In 1905, Joseph had become a mayor. The chattering classes say Braithwaite had delivered finally on a promise made to his late mother that he would someday become mayor of the city of Hamilton. This is a myth that needs to be put to rest. It's not true. Thank you. in the local government elections of 2001. There's no doubt that New Zealand wanted the change, and they voted for it, with over 30 new mayors elected across the nation. The bottom line is that these are sackings with no case for personal grievance or wrongful dismissal, or even the prospect of a golden handshake. Politics is a brutal, brutal business. So misunderstood. It's been an odd few days after the elections and leading up to Labour weekend, 2001. The idiot who sent white powder through the New Zealand mail system got me going. If there's anything that creates paranoia, that's it. It's not acceptable. The black humour is around, even in Aotearoa, and should be dealt with the way airport security staff are dealing with it. Black humour is best kept very personal on a one-to-one basis, computer to computer. The reality is that making jokes about bombs and firearms in your luggage is not acceptable. When you drive past the Waikato Mail Centre, then in London Street, and see it blocked off, police, security tape, you wonder what the world's come to. At least in our little corner of the planet, 2001. Big Bob Comer from Waikato Security is standing there with his equally big men on guard, and you suddenly focus on how reliant we've become on the postal system and how the terrorist attack in New York has changed the way we are. The entire business of the region grinds to a halt for a couple of days, as the checks are in the mail, for some, for the first time, truthfully, along with legal documents and other vital bits and pieces. That's the sad thing. It takes a real anthrax scare, with deaths in the United States, for the Kiwi nutters to come out of their grubby holes. The cretins who joke about bombs in their suitcases are just as bad. It's not acceptable. That aside, I'd like to move on to both a negative and a positive and talk about the community leader who's making a difference in the community of 2001, Martin Elliott. If you don't instantly recognize his name, he's the principal of Fraser High School. Since arriving in town, Martin Elliott has demanded performance from his students. Play hooky and you're back in school out of hours to catch up, or you're out. The wrong uniform? You're home to get it. It's about discipline. It's about Saturday school for those who really want it to catch up on their grades. There's going to be a generation of former Fraser High students who will look back on Martin Elliott and acknowledge his leadership. We had a man like him at Hamilton Boys High in the 1950s and 60s. Aubrey Bagent, who expected nothing but the best from his boys, and in much later years still clearly remembered names and the incidents you'd hoped were long since forgotten. In recent weeks, Martin Elliott has had to deal with the arson destruction of the school's about-to-be-completed gymnasium. Four worthless little sods, for whom I have no sympathy, did the damage. Yes, and they did it because they were misunderstood. And all of the other usual weasel words. Martin Elliott's decision to get these four kids to turn up to a full assembly to say why they did it and to apologize for their actions was greater justice than any court could have handed out. It took the concept of a family conference to new heights. The idea to bring the victims and the offenders together to talk through, to understand each other's point of view. I'm really angry you broke into my house and stole my irreplaceable antique jewellery. Oh, gee, I've been given a smoking a joint. My mum was at home drunk. My stepfather's in jail. And I've just got my 14-year-old girlfriend pregnant. Yeah, and I was bored and was just walking past your home and thought, that looks like a rich person's house. Why not do a burglary? The outcome, hopefully, is to hug each other, make up and say sorry to the deepest of understanding about how each other feels? Really? So Martin Elliott's stroke of genius is to make the offenders face an entire school. It's the mother of all family conferences. There's a real problem with our society when these kids can't decide for themselves what's wrong and right. It has to be about parenting skills or the huge need for them. I was lecturing recently to 200 students at the University of Waikato School of Management Studies on ethics in public relations. That ethics is now a taught subject is a bit of a worry. Asked to define ethics, I told them to check out the biblical definition, the Ten Commandments, which is probably a good place to start, learning about values and respect. We've also had that incredible story where a community police constable gets abused by a punk kid in a school in Auckland and handcuffs him. The police end up forking out $15,000 taxpayer dollars because the kid's sensitivities have been hurt. Doesn't that make you sick? The community needs to get behind their community cops, not compromising them and putting their jobs in jeopardy. These kids today are winning the war when years ago the big Maori cop, Buff Henry, walked the Victoria Street beat on Friday night. You didn't talk back to Buff. Today, we'd have him up against the ropes and out of the force for brutality. We're thinking about a back-to-basics approach. Published in the Waikato Times on October the 25th, 2001. The opinions of Gordon Chesterman. Bad politicians are elected by good citizens who don't vote. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home. Country roads, take me home. Country roads, take me home. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.